This episode is brought to you by Hill's Pet Nutrition. Every shelter pet deserves a second chance, and you're making it possible for thousands of them every day. Because when you feed your pet Hill's, you help feed a shelter pet, which helps make them healthy, happy, and more adoptable, changing their life forever. So they can change yours. Over 14 million shelter pets fed and adopted. Science did that. Visit hillspet.com/podcast to learn more.
If you'd like to listen to our podcasts without ads, please consider becoming a member. In addition to no ads, members receive bonus content for virtually all of our shows, an invitation to join the DSR Slack community, access to our Discord community, enhanced show notes for select shows, and more. For this week only, get 50% off the first year or the first month of membership. Visit thedsrnetwork.com/buy and use code ECLIPSE to receive the discount. That's thedsrnetwork.com/buy and code ECLIPSE. Thank you very much for your support.
Nine, 12, 10, 28, 2, 23.
This is Deep State Radio, coming to you direct from our super secret studio in the third sub-basement of the Ministry of Snark in Washington, D.C., and from other undisclosed locations across America and around the world.
Hello and welcome to the podcast. I'm your host, David Rothkopf, and every so often, as you know, what we do is we take a break from our usual panel discussions about all the mayhem in the world and talk about a book we think you should read. And boy, do we have one that is just perfect for everybody out there. Came out about 6 weeks ago. The author is Carlos Luzada. He's an opinion columnist at the New York Times and co-host of the Matter of Opinion podcast. He is a Pulitzer Prize winner and author of The Washington Book, How to Read Politics and Politicians. How are you doing, Carlos?
Great. Thanks for having me on the show.
Well, it's great to have you here, Carlos. The book that you've written, The Washington Book, How to Read Politics and Politicians, is just perfect for our audience who tunes into the podcast here at the DSR Network to get an inside perspective on Washington. And I think over the course of your time as a book reviewer at the Washington Post and as a columnist at the New York Times, you've sort of become the master reader of Washington's internal monologue. And I think that's what makes this book so interesting, is that you don't sort of take these books at face value, but you read between the lines of each of them. I'm wondering to what degree that's your intent to begin with.
Oh, it's very much the intent. Whenever people learn that this is how I make a living, you know, by reading Washington memoirs and special counsel investigations and commission reports, I always get this like look of pity, and people say, thanks for reading those books so that we don't have to. And the implication is that, you know, these are bad books or boring books or sort of ghostwritten propaganda. But I'm a real believer in Washington books. I find them incredibly useful. And I think that's because even when politicians are trying to present themselves in the most benign and favorable light, as they do in these books, you know, when they sanitize their records and their experiences, they still find ways, despite themselves, to reveal themselves, to show us who they are. And it's rarely the super sort of sexy and newsy material. You know, it's not like the five takeaways from so-and-so's book. It's just little things. It's a recurring line. It's a throwaway comment. It's something in the acknowledgments of a book that says something about who they are and their character. And no one else seems to want to do it. So I've kind of made it my thing now for the better part of a decade.
Well, as somebody who does it inadvertently myself, everybody is grateful for the role that you play doing it. When you talk about, you know, picking up on a little line, there are examples that leap out in this book. You cite, for example, the vice president who wrote a book before she became vice president, and in it she talks about false choices, and you then use that as a springboard to talk about how, at least in that phase of her career, she was unwilling to make choices. So maybe you're a little psychoanalyst too.
I'll accept that, but I just think that I'm just reading. I'm just reading diligently and carefully. And the case of Harris, you know, it was funny because I was waiting to see who Biden was going to choose as his running mate. The Washington political crowd, the reporters were telling us that it was going to be either Kamala Harris or Susan Rice. And so I had both books on my desk. You know, each one has written a memoir. And I was going to just immediately crash on whichever one was chosen. But I was rooting for Harris in part because her book was a lot shorter, and I knew I could read it quickly and turn a piece around right away. But the thing is, you know, I don't go into these exercises with a kind of preconceived idea of, you know, what I think about the person or what I'm going to write about. Sometimes something just leaps out at you. And in the case of Harris, it's how she would use this phrase, this term, false choices. She said, look, people say that I care more about the rights of immigrants than about the rights of Americans, undocumented immigrants over the rights of American citizens. That's not true. That's a false choice. It's a false choice that I have to care more about, you know, either police accountability or the rights of you know, citizens who are questioned or detained by police. That's not a false choice. And I mean, in some ways she could be right. I think there are things that are in fact false choices, and it sounds very sage to kind of point them out. But politics is all about making difficult choices among competing priorities, about throwing more weight behind one or another position. And so it just struck me that, you know, maybe she doesn't want to make some of these difficult choices. So as a result, she says they aren't real. And that's the kind of thing that to my mind, helps me understand maybe why she's had a hard time carving out a very distinctive role until recently, perhaps, as VP.
Yeah, I think the more she gets to what she truly believes, the better she does. Just even listening to you here, when you use the term reading, I don't think you mean the same thing that everybody else does, because I think a lot of people read things and just what they mean by that is taking things at face value, and that there is a more active kind of reading where you look at things, you critically assess them. You even get so far as you say, well, what does this ellipsis mean? What was deleted here? And why was it deleted? And I think it'd be useful for the reader, the listener here, to understand what an active reader of these books does that's different from what a passive reader does.
Sure. A couple of things, and I hope I don't get too deep in the weeds, although this is Deep State Radio, so I think it's fine. But
it could just as easily be called Deep in the Weeds Radio.
Deep in the Weeds, there you go. That's like a combo of you guys and Vox or something.
Exactly.
But so first off, one thing I do is that I read, you know, any book that I'm writing about or any document or report that I'm, or a Supreme Court opinion, you know, take your pick, that I'm writing about, I read three times. I read it first, just, you know, straight through, taking lots of notes, you know, highlighting, underlining things, notes in the margins, looking at footnotes. Then I set it aside and I come back to it and I read it twice more, each time sort of culling a smaller sort of subset of insights and ideas and questions and quotes from these books, so that by the time I'm done, I have, you know, my own set of notes that then I use as a substitute for the book. I set the book aside and I use that smaller subset of notes as just my own raw material for the book. That process takes a long, long time. It usually works out, like I only recently figured this out, that it works out to about, let's say 1,000 words per 100 pages of a book. So say I read a 400-page book, I might end up with a 4,000 or up to 5,000 word file, you know, which are just all my notes. And from there, I start looking for you know, leads and themes and ideas. So, you know, that's simply the process of how I read sort of any given book. But often, as you mentioned, you know, reading the words that politicians write is about not just, you know, seeing what's there, but seeing what's missing. One notable case for me was the case of Mike Pence in his memoir, So Help Me God, that came out in 2022. There, Pence devotes a lot of time to the events of January 6th, in particular, you know, his role in standing up to the president and not decertifying the results of the election. But he does one thing that really struck me, and that is he quotes at length from Donald Trump's video statement that afternoon when Trump finally told the rioters to leave the Capitol. And Pence quotes him saying that, look, I know you're hurting. I know your pain, dot, 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 with an ellipsis there. But you have to go home now. We have to have peace. And Trump did say those words. But when I read it, I immediately wondered, you know, what did Pence omit, right? What did he skip over with that ellipsis? So I went back to look at the original video. And I saw that right in the middle of that phrase of Trump's statement, he had said, I know your pain. I know your hurt. This was a landslide election that was stolen from us. Everyone knows it, including the other side. And only then did Trump go on to say, but you have to go home now. We have to have peace. So, you know, even when he's looking back, when Mike Pence is looking back on the events of January 6th, when Trump did nothing to help him, when Trump supporters were calling for his hanging, when the Capitol was being overrun, even then, Pence was still covering for his boss. He was still omitting the most damning material that Trump issued in that statement. And to me, that was remarkable. You know, in the memoir, Pence, whenever Trump asks him to do anything, Pence always says, you know, I'm here to serve. And he was there to serve even on that day.
Yeah, I that's exactly why this is so rich and useful. And yet, I we've been in Washington almost the same amount of time. I've been here a little bit longer. But, you know, you start to read things differently here in Washington. You know, you see an article, and at the top of an article, it says, an unnamed source says blah, 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 blah. And then down at the bottom of the article, it says, Bob Jones, assistant secretary for whatever, is a really brilliant, insightful person on this issue. And you say, oh, so the unnamed source was Bob Jones. And, you know, I don't see how you can help but read these things from that perspective. But having said that, you know, you have maintained a degree of equanimity here that I have to admire, even though I find it a little frightening at times. For example, you found something of value in a book written by Josh Hawley.
Oh, yeah, I did. Sorry,
How did you do that?
I was wondering where you were going to go. But the way I did it was by not entering the process of reading with all my predispositions about Josh Hawley, right? I wanted to see what he said in the book. So he wrote this book about manhood, which has become this sort of recurring theme among certain parts of the Republican Party and the conservative movement. You know, it's all about manning up and being tough in this kind of like Trumpy macho, you know, vibe. And a lot of the reviews of this book, if you look back on them now, just seem like they were written kind of by people who made no bones of just being, predisposed to kind of not stand Josh Hawley. And, you know, I thought that some of the things he had to say about the plight of of, you know, young men in particular in the United States today, you know, is stuff that echoes the work of other writers who maybe are more palatable to the left, or to those who don't like Josh Hawley. You know, but what struck me most about his book was that, you know, there was one essential contradiction at the heart of it. And that is that on the one hand, he's telling young men in America to, you know, take responsibility for their own situations, you know, to like be the men that their fathers and grandfathers were, to be tough and essentially to man up. On the other hand, in the very same breath, he's telling them that, you know, the blame for everything, for the entire plight of contemporary American manhood, falls to the, you know, the godless left, right? And so he's telling you to take responsibility and telling you who's to blame for it. And those things don't really work well together. It reminded me of Josh Hawley on January 6th, you know, when, you know, early on he's out there, you know, raising his fist in support of the rioters, and then you see him running, you know, through the Capitol hallways, right? This was similar to his book. This is a book that sort of like, you know, raises its fist and then runs for cover. But his concerns about, you know, the deterioration of male friendships and male relationships, you know, all these things are things that are real and have been made clear by a lot of other writers and scholars who he was echoing. I'm not going to dismiss everything Josh Hawley writes based on my particular political predispositions. And I think that readers appreciate that. I think readers are more inclined to have an interest in what I've learned rather than just what I think. And that's a distinction I try to keep in mind when I'm reading and writing about political books.
So as you look at the world of these books, surely you notice the trends that a lot of us read about. For example, recently I've seen a couple of articles saying, "Oh, books about Biden don't sell, and books about Trump do sell." And you know, people obviously look for a degree of drama and entertainment in their books. And competency is not that entertaining. What do you make of that?
I mean, that was part of Biden's pitch, wasn't it? Like, you know, if you elect me, you're not going to have to think about the president every day of the week, right? You're, you know, I will, you know, make America boring again is, it wasn't a terrible slogan. I mean, not that was their slogan, but it, you know, it wasn't a terrible idea following the mayhem of the Trump years. It doesn't. It certainly doesn't bother me if, you know, books about the Biden presidency don't sell as well as books about the Trump presidency. If, as you suggest, it's because of the sort of straightforward competence that a new administration has brought. I think that's fine. I think that's fine. Now, I've been reading a lot of the Biden a lot of the books about the Biden presidency. I recently read Frank Foer's book, The Last Politician, and I'm going back and reading some of Biden's own memoirs. He has a couple, and there's plenty to learn in them. I usually don't pay a lot of attention to the sales of books. I find that some of the books that I found most useful in understanding politics are not big sellers.
One of the things that strikes me is that a lot of these books fall into one of two categories. They're either, you know, by journalists, kind of first draft of history, or if they're by politically active folks, politicians and others, then it falls into sort of propaganda or trying to build the narrative in some way. And yet one of the things we've learned is one doesn't really know how to assess events in Washington in real time. Sometimes things that look bad turn out to be good. Sometimes people who look like they had terrible records turn out, you know, in retrospect, not to have had such a terrible record. You know, the Vietnam War was a disaster, but Vietnam's sort of quasi-capitalist and doing better, and we have good relations with them now, and maybe it turned out okay. Nixon was a crook, but he also had a pretty successful agenda. How do you sort of pull back the lens and try to find anything that's going to, you know, sort of have some lasting resonance rather than getting all caught up in the weeds again of the day-to-day narrative of the media?
Yeah. Part of it, I think, just involves, like, you just have to keep coming back to the same debates, the same events, the same moments, and think of ways to continually reassess, right? Like, I think of you know, George W. Bush, you know, landing on the aircraft carrier, the mission accomplished banner. Like, if you recall, in the moment, a lot of Democrats and others were upset that he had used, you know, the equipment of the U.S. military for what was obviously a you know, campaign type photo op, right? As if the memory of that moment was going to be a positive one, right? Which is not at all what happened. You know, with that image. That image now is a stand-in for hubris, is a stand-in for, like, the ultimate and kind of misguided, you know, victory lapping. And so I think, like, for me, I just need to keep returning to a particular moment. When we reached the 20th anniversary of the 9/11 attacks, I took a few months to read, you know, 20 plus books that dealt with different parts of our 9/11 experience. You know, a chunk of them dealt with that day, a chunk of them dealt with the years leading up to it, a chunk of them dealt with, you know, how we responded in the immediate aftermath. Others dealt with, you know, the wars that followed. Others connected the 9/11 era to the Trump era. And really only by that particular exercise was I able to help myself understand, you know, well, how do I think about this? You know, I often look back to the things that I wrote, like, right in the moment when I'm responding to a particular event or a particular book that's very timely, that seems very timely, to try to understand how I thought about it in real time. But that's never the last word. I mean, at least it shouldn't be.
Well, in conversations like this, there shouldn't be a last word ever, because they're good conversations and I'm really interested in carrying it forward. But we have a limited amount of time. So let me ask you one last question. Mm-hmm. And the last question is, you know, as you know, you know me, I'm like, you know, sometimes I write one of these books every couple of years, and I yep. like reading these books and whatever. Like, what books? What are the Washington authors missing out on that I should go write a book about right now?
Oh gosh, you know,
I mean, it's not that personal. I'm just thinking. You know, you're sitting here reading this stuff, and there must be a certain sameness to a lot of it, and there must be a bunch of things that you wish you would see addressed that aren't addressed.
Yeah, there is a sameness to a lot of it. I also have to be careful about what it is that I choose to read, right? And I fall into traps of, you know, liking certain kinds of themes and subjects. I don't know that there are a lot of books that or a lot of topics that aren't being addressed that I want addressed. I just think that I want some of the same topics addressed from different vantage points, right? Like, if you look at the Trump presidency, for instance, right? The 2017 to 2021 term. Early on, a lot of the books about Trump seem to be as channeled by Steve Bannon, right? A lot of the early books seem to have that kind of storytelling behind it. Michael Wolff's first book on Trump, Fire and Fury, is a great example. In the latter stages of the Trump presidency, a lot of the books on Trump seem to be in part channeled via Mark Milley, right? And those are both useful and important and very contrasting perspectives. But God, there have to be more, right? And that's my main concern. Not that we're not covering the right subjects, but that we get into sort of easy grooves in how it is that we cover them. And so, you know, finding different voices, different avenues to explore the same stories, that's what appeals to me and what allows me to come back, you know, months or years later and really understand a moment. It's through that multiplicity of perspectives on a single particular theme.
You know, that's such an interesting point. Because, you know, when you mention Mark Milley, there's certain people out there who seem to develop, you know, a list of the people they know are writing big books, and they get in touch with all of them, or they make themselves available to all of them, and they shape the narrative. And, you know, in some ways, the authors of the Washington books aren't the people who write them necessarily. It's some of those people who speak to a lot of them. And I know from my own experience, you know, the very, very first one of these books I ever wrote was on the National Security Council, and I would write about different moments in history, and was struck by the fact that, you know, when I was dealing with the Dayton peace process, for example, you know, I would get a bunch of people who said to me, Anthony Lake was the hero of this. And then a bunch of other people saying, no, Dick Holbrook was the hero. And they would start calling me, trying to shape how this was going to be reported. And that's kind of an invisible part of the process of these Washington books, isn't it?
No, I think you're right. I think that's just something that that we need to be aware of both as readers and as writers.
Well, Carlos, first of all, congratulations on the book, the Washington book. I encourage everybody to go out and to get it. It's really essential, sort of as a Rosetta Stone, a way of decoding Washington and understanding these books better. And I always look forward to reading what you have to write. So I hope we continue to have this conversation at some point in the future. But for now, thank you. Congratulations. Thank you, everybody, for listening. And we'll be back with another podcast, probably in just a few hours, because that's the way we work. Bye-bye.